From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's get right to North Carolina, where Governor Pat McCrory is warning people to ready for more flooding as water unleashed by Hurricane Matthew surges through rivers. Will Michaels of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, part of our Contributors Network, joins us from Chapel Hill. Will, what are the fears?
The Tar River is at 23 feet right now, and it still hasn't actually crested. That's kind of what we're dealing with for the rest of the week here, is this tricky sort of concept of figuring out when each of these main rivers in eastern North Carolina is going to crest. The governor has said, please listen to these evacuations. 9,000 people in the city of Greenville have been evacuated this morning. And over the next few days, the river is expected to get to record levels, about 25 feet. A lot of people are comparing this storm to Hurricane Floyd in 1999, which had similar effects.
Yeah. And what are the concerns? We see the homes underwater, businesses underwater, but what else are people keeping an eye on?
The thing that we're keeping an eye on for the next few days is actually water quality. We actually have about the same number of hogs in North Carolina as we do people, about 10 million. And if you see these hog farms, you can see very distinctly there are hog waste lagoons out behind these farms. Obviously, if that were to overflow into the floodwaters, it could prove to be really nasty downstream. The state agriculture department has said that there are no reports of hog waste lagoon breaches so far. There are also some poultry plants that are totally underwater. The governor himself has actually said that there are thousands of livestock that are likely dead in the floodwaters. It's going to take several more days to clean that up and make sure that people in eastern North Carolina actually have clean water to drink.
Well, it's of course, it's a health hazard, but it's heartbreaking. Terrible. Will Michaels of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Even outside the flooded areas, torrential rains wiped out crops for the second year in a row for many farmers. Jerry Hamill farms peanuts, cotton, and soybeans at Latrosse Farms in Enfield, North Carolina. And Jerry, by the way, does Latrosse stand for something?
Yes, it does. It's what we used to tell our children. Love you all the time, rain or shine.
Aw. You're having a hard time.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's talk about it. What are you seeing in the fields?
Well, you know, we had a really good crop started, and, you know, fine until last Saturday. Everybody was looking forward to a good crop for 2016 to heal some of the wounds from 2015. And, you know, we had it going until this storm came in. And, you know, right now the fields are too wet to get in. And, of course, you know, the only thing we can do now is hope and pray for good weather where we can get in the field and you know, try to salvage this crop, you know, plow the peanuts up that are not plowed up and pick the ones that are plowed up.
Can they dry out? Can you salvage some of the peanuts?
Yeah. I'm not going to say we can't because you never know, but we're going to lose some peanuts, no question about it. We're going to lose some cotton. Some cotton was blown out that was open, and some will be lost too when water gets into the bowl and it gets too much in that. It's called what they call hard lock. The bowl will not open and fluff out where the pickers can pick it. So that's just gone. The picker won't pick it. It'll just knock it on the ground. So that's a waste there.
Well, Jerry, you remind us that it's, you know, just not just the flood. It's people with the heavy rains. But are you covered by either your own crop insurance for flooding or by some kind of the federal assistance that we're hearing about if you weren't in the flood?
Well, I do have federal crop insurance. It's going to help some, but it will not cover the expenses, but it'll help a great deal, you know.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of room for improvement with federal crop insurance, yeah. No question about it.
Well, we know that gets debated in Congress.
Oh, yeah, every time and all the time. And that's the sad part when we don't have many congressmen or senators now that are from an ag background, which is sad. I mean, we don't have a good, strong voice in Washington anymore.
Well, Jerry, you know, it sounds like Matthew has given you quite a punch here. Do you think about quitting?
No. You know, you've got such a huge investment when you farm now. I mean, basically, I'm in it. I have a tremendous amount of money tied up in equipment and land. That's my life. I mean, I've been doing it a long time.
Well, Jerry Hamill of the Love You All the Time, Rain or Shine Farm.
Yep.
We wish you a lot of shine.
That'd be good. Yeah, we need it. I cannot remember ever having this wide a spread area affected as badly. You know, we've had hurricanes, yes, and we'll have them again. But to do this much damage just from basically rainfall is just hard to, you know, it's kind of hard to stomach, really.
Well, Jerry, I mean, we're going to post your farm at our website, and maybe people will contact you directly. And just thank you so much, and we wish you all the best.
Well, I thank you very much.
Again, Jerry Hamill, owner of Latrobe Farms in Enfield, North Carolina.
Well, much of the talk about border security in this election season has centered on Donald Trump's proposal to build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. But the U.S. government has a different kind of security effort underway right now, targeting drug cartel lookouts who are tracking Border Patrol agents within U.S. borders. There's an operation designed to find these scouts before they spot border security. Michelle Marisco from the Fronteras desk at Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports.
There's no visible trail along this hard granite slope. Boulders perch on smaller rocks and look as if they haven't been disturbed in millennia until they slide down the mountain. The West Desert is among the most haunting and unforgiving of regions in Arizona. The nearest highway is State Route 85, running from the town of Ajo, 40 miles to the Mexican border. And perhaps because of that desolation, someone has been perched here, high in the mountains, watching the movements of federal agents roaming the desert below.
Socks, some of the trash, the lids, the Tabasco, you know, some of the hot sauce, pots and pans they used to cook.
Agent Paul is a tracker with the U.S. Border Patrol's Operation Waypoint, a mountain scout tracking team based in Ajo. He asked we not use his full name for security concerns. He digs through the remnants of a campsite roughly 800 feet above the desert.
Here's some carpet booties. They use this to mask their foot sign when they cross, when they cross the open expanses in the soft terrain.
This campsite is only about halfway up the mountain. The agent continues upwards now through black lava rocks and slippery quartz. It's a favorite place for what agents call spotters. In Mexico, the scouts are known as halcones, falcons.
You can see right there's Montezuma's head. There's the Ajo Range. There's nothing you really can't see here.
For years, Agent Paul and the Border Patrol's Tucson sector, whose operations cover most of Arizona, were plagued by these mountain scouts radioing down agents' positions to their envoys moving people and drugs across the border, as quick and elusive as their bird of prey namesake. But then one day in November 2014, Agent Paul got a break when he spotted a pair of heads shifting on a mountaintop.
So we talked to the pilot, and the pilot was like, yeah, I'll try to see. I said, there's probably not a place to land. I said, you might just be able to put one skid down and us jump out.
The Border Patrol pilot landed one chopper skid on a boulder, and Agent Paul and his partner stepped off onto the mountaintop. They caught two men. His partner chased a third.
There was like a little cave real close to me, and I started looking through the cave. There was a lot of trash. So when I got to the trash, I started digging through it, and I found a pair of binos. I found, I think, a couple phones, some solar panels. I think there was one or two radios.
One of the men he arrested was Abelardo Niebla Torres. Agent Vicente Paco had encountered Niebla Torres 2 years before.
What they were doing is they were dropping him off along with supplies and along with other individuals to scout this location.
Federal prosecutors were able to tie that previous case to this one and used it to prove that Niebla Torres was scouting out safe passage for drug traffickers.
Wasn't a coincidence that he was in a mountaintop. You know, it was a prior arrest showed that he was doing the similar things.
He testified about that previous arrest in court.
He was arrested in the same circumstances. He was arrested with gear that was used at the time and now for scouting activity. He was arrested with supplies. He was arrested with solar panels.
Since then, prosecutors have brought cases against about 80 of these scouts in the Tucson sector. Niebla Torres was found guilty of conspiracy last year. Rosemarie Valdez represented him in court.
The government is basically prosecuting these individuals that are found in caves or on mountaintops because of what they allege is scouting equipment. despite the lack of evidence that they're actually part of a conspiracy.
She filed an appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It was taken under consideration by the court in early September. Back on that mountaintop, Agent Paul is readying for what he anticipates will be more scouts, maybe the one who left this frying pan behind. The marijuana harvest season starts this month in Mexico. But after his arrest of Nevla Torres, he's optimistic.
If you can take away the scout, you've basically leveled the playing field.
For Here and Now, I'm Michel Marisco in Southern Arizona.
Another 1,100 emails from the account of Hillary Clinton's campaign chair, John Podesta, have been released by WikiLeaks after a hack that Podesta is blaming on Russian hackers. He says there's a reasonable chance that longtime Donald Trump advisor Roger Stone had advanced warning about the hack. Stone denies that. Meanwhile, the White House is officially accusing Russia of being behind election hacks, including the hack of the Democratic National Committee over the summer, saying that it believed Russia is actively trying to affect the outcome of the U.S. election. That's something Malcolm Nance agrees with. He's a career intelligence officer and the executive director of the Terror Asymmetrics Project on Strategy, Tactics, and Radical Ideology. And he's got a new book called The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. Malcolm Nance, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
And you came up with the title of your book before we had the Obama administration finally coming out and saying it was Russia that was behind the hacks on the Democratic National Committee. But why do you say that Putin's cyber spies and WikiLeaks are trying to steal the election?
Well, all the evidence points to that direction. It's pretty clear. And the reason the president came out well after my book went to print is because the president has 19 intelligence agencies who must all corroborate and determine whether they actually want to release information of that level of sensitivity. Because to determine whether Russia did it or not would require us to have to brief the president on some extremely advanced cyber capabilities that the National Security Agency and physical human intelligence that the Central Intelligence Agency would have. As for me, I saw all the evidence as I was developing this book on ISIS hacking, and it became pretty clear that the fingerprints from global cybersecurity companies were seeing FSB, which is the Russian Central Intelligence Agency, formerly known as the KGB, and their version of NSA. Their fingerprints were all over the hacks, and their fingerprints were all over many other cyber warfare operations over the last decade.
And what does it tell you that WikiLeaks is where these hacked emails are being put? Is there a connection between WikiLeaks and the Russian intelligence agencies?
Well, Julian Assange made it very clear that he seems to blame Hillary Clinton for getting him into the circumstance that he's trapped inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And he said that his leaks of information, where he won't name the source, but it's pretty obvious that it came from the Guccifer 2.0, which is the cover name for Russian intelligence's data dump, that it came from there and that he intended to harm Hillary Clinton. And that's why the evidence, you know, WikiLeaks themselves are not actually hacking. WikiLeaks right now is a laundromat for Russian intelligence. And their veracity of whatever they've done in the past is out the window now.
Is it your expectation that the extent of the hacking will be releasing private emails, or do you expect that hackers, that Russian hackers perhaps, will try to get into our voting systems or alter the vote count or change, you know, registration databases?
I have to assume, as an intelligence professional, and I've been doing this for over 35 years, I have to assume that an enemy that would take on the intelligence challenge, as led by the spy master in chief, Vladimir Putin, former director of the KGB, that they would see this as a strategic mission in which they would feel there is no risk or little risk that the United States will respond in kind. They have made that decision. They hacked the DNC. They released this data. So next, the question is, how much chaos would they really want? Nina Khrushcheva, who's at the New School, a Russian specialist and granddaughter of Khrushchev himself, she believes that Putin is unstable, but he's also a pragmatic leader. Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, he also believes that Putin would not want to completely destabilize the United States. However, we've seen within the campaign for Donald Trump these extremely well-timed releases right after he's given campaign speeches, like the one in Pennsylvania where he said, if we don't win Pennsylvania, then this election will have been rigged. Well, within a few days, the entire DNC email package on everything related to the state of Pennsylvania was released in bulk through WikiLeaks. The same thing happened with Florida. Within 24 hours of a speech in Florida, the entire DNC package on Florida was released to the public. Russia itself, if they want to, they're not going to hack the election, the Diebold, you know, electronic voting machines. They will go after the vote tallies that are going to be in PCs or laptops within the states themselves. And all it would take is an obvious hack in changing the voter tally in one column for 5 minutes so that they would people would know that there had been a hack, and then putting the numbers back to where they were in order to degrade the confidence of the election and quite possibly give one of the opponents in this election the opportunity to say that this election should be nullified or this election was stolen. That could lead to civil disturbance or even worse.
That's Malcolm Nance, a career intelligence officer. His book is called The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. And Malcolm Nance, if we know that it's Russia, why can't the United States stop it from happening or fight back?
The president made his statement last week about what he intended to do. And he said, we are aware that Russia is behind this. We know the agencies and organizations that are part of this and that the United States will respond in a place and time of its choosing. That means that the president has essentially declared that we will carry out an operation at some point. We have a good electronic warfare and cyber warfare capability. We just don't use it maliciously every day as Russia does. You know, Russia last year shut down 3 power plants in the Ukraine, took control of them remotely just to demonstrate to the Ukraine that they could destroy their physical infrastructure.
Do we have the capability to do that? Could the United States do that if we wanted to at this point?
Sure. As a matter of fact, if anyone wants, there's a video you can watch on YouTube called the Aurora Generator Test. And it's a Department of Energy test over a decade ago where they took control of a generator for a power plant, you know, remotely, and then had it self-destruct. But at that point, you're moving from the realm of black space espionage into open warfare using remote electronic weapon systems. And that's what these cyber packages are.
I guess the question, though, is if we have the ability to do something like that, why can't we stop them from doing these things to us?
Well, cyber defense and cyber offense are two entirely different realms. They're symbiotic. They do work together. But it's always easier to create an offensive weapon system which destroys something than to have that you know, giant net that's going to catch it and stop that. And this is because, unlike Russia, the United States has, you know, private institutions which create these systems, and they are not all regulated by the government. The National Security Agency does not make your virus scanner. They do make them for the United States government. But we've still seen in areas of the surface web, you know, where most people go, there are still ways to get around that.
There was an interesting comment from the former counterterrorism official Richard Clark on ABC's This Week talking about the email hacks that we have already seen. And here's what he said about his new concerns.
So they've already hacked and dumped real emails. They've established that they've got real emails. The second dump, which I expect will come in the next couple of weeks, may have salted into thousands of real emails, forged or altered emails. How can you then prove that they're forged?
Now, the second dump did come, and we don't know. I mean, people are still going through all of these emails. But do you share that concern that the Russian hackers could alter some email and make it look like somebody has said something terrible?
I wrote a whole book about it, as a matter of fact. I've been warning for about 10 weeks now, nonstop, on NBC News, that after the DNC hack, almost immediately. I saw that that information is what we call a scripted operation, where information is released precisely where you want it to. So the first morning of the DNC, where you had the Bernie Sanders emails come from the DNC's own servers, those were real. They always take their best shot with real data. Anything that comes after that is going to be what we call black propaganda. That's where you have a real email or data stream or letters. I mean, the KGB used to do this with physical letters. And then you would change a word, a phrase, or a sentence within them and then put it back into that stream to where once it was released, it could possibly be proven false, but it would already be out in the public right. realm. And you would have a very, very hard time putting the genie back into the bottle, even if you had all the evidence, which is why the Russian fingerprints on this don't really matter. People are more concerned with the content rather than the fact that we have actually, as a nation, been attacked by using these methodologies.
That's Malcolm Nance, who is a career intelligence officer. He's executive director of the Terror Asymmetrics Project on Strategy, Tactics, and Radical Ideology, and the author of the new book, The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. Malcolm, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And by the way, one of the hacked emails from John Podesta was about his thoughts on how to make risotto. He advocates a slower ad process with regards to liquid, and the website Epicurious says he's right on risotto.
Lyme disease is one of the most common infectious diseases in the U.S. The government says about 329,000 people are infected every year, suffering body aches, joint pain, even serious neurological problems. But there might be another tick-borne bacterium, the Swiss agent, complicating Lyme infections. Charles Piller is the West Coast editor of STAT, the National Health and Medical Publication, and our weekly partner. He joins us by Skype. Charles, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Robin.
And what is this Swiss agent?
The Swiss agent was discovered by this guy, Willy Burgdorfer, who's the discoverer also of the causative agent of Lyme. And the Swiss agent was found earlier. It was thought at the time possibly to be the cause of Lyme. Further research showed that it wasn't the cause of Lyme, but they had vowed to continue to look into it, thinking that it might be a significant organism or possibly still a cause of Lyme. They just didn't get around to completing that research. This was back in the late 70s, early 80s. Then the cause of Lyme, a different microbe, was found. And the research into the Swiss agent was ostensibly forgotten and dropped.
Well, we know that after Willy Burgdorfer died, documents were found, you know, tucked away in his garage. On one, he'd written a note. It's kind of chilling because he even writes, "I wondered why somebody didn't do something. Then I realized I was somebody." Sounds like he was criticizing himself for not following up on the Swiss agent.
Well, one of his closest colleagues, a professor at Stony Brook University, feels that it shows clear remorse that he didn't follow up on something very important, that note that you just read. It's intriguing and mysterious, and it makes you wonder, what was it about this that so intrigued Burgdorfer and that so worried him in his later years?
Well, what are some of the complications that we're seeing now that might be clues to that? I mean, what are some of the things that people suspect might be happening with the Swiss agent now?
Well, there are a couple things that are newly understood over the years since the discovery of the Swiss agent. One is that it's been associated with a wide range of extremely serious human illnesses, including heart ailments and a variety of problems that mimic or overlap the symptoms of Lyme, especially the Lyme that's untreated. As a result, there are many who think that these kinds of infections might be confusing the diagnosis and treatment of Lyme.
Well, many people know there are controversies within the medical community about Lyme. Some people aren't believed. There's questions about diagnosis, and this might have something to do with that. But meantime, going forward, Charles, we're presuming that a lot more people are going to take a closer look at the Swiss agent.
Well, experts at the CDC and also at academic institutions have already said that they can do a comprehensive look in human blood and also in ticks to learn whether this Swiss agent is infecting people in Lyme endemic areas in the United States. If it is, it could be causing confusion in the diagnosis and treatment of Lyme for two reasons. One is that it could be causing a co-infection with Lyme that complicates diagnosis and treatment or worsens Lyme. Second, it could be causing independent infections that people mistake for Lyme.
That's Charles Pillar, West Coast editor of STAT. Charles, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
It is time now for a classical edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. And joining us today is Vic DiGeronimo, who hosts Classic Mornings on WILL-FM, Illinois Public Media, in Urbana, Illinois, my hometown. Vic, welcome back.
Jeremy, I'm always excited to be with you and the Here and Now listeners. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And you've got some interesting music for pianos today. And let's start with this duet. It's called The Ritual Fire Dance. It's by Spanish composer Manuel de Falla and performed here by Katia and Marielle Lebec. So, Vic, I have this weird musical memory where I can, if I've heard something before, I can tell that I've heard it before, even if I can't figure out from where. But what that means here, because I definitely recognize this, is that my father, who's a concert pianist, has definitely played this in our house at some point.
I'm sure he has. It's a work that's been played on solo piano. It's actually originally from a ballet called El Amor Brujo, or Love the Magician, but it has become a piano showpiece. But here, it's arranged for two players at one piano, which is known as piano four hands. And you have the advantage in this performance of being able to represent the colors of the orchestra more fully because you've got four hands instead of two, and that's the whole point of piano duet, or one of the points of piano duet or piano four hands, two players at one keyboard.
Is there a difference in the sound between four hands on the same keyboard and two pianos?
There is, and what happens is with two pianos, you actually have two pianists who have access to the full ranges of those two pianos, and usually that's the kind of thing that makes its way onto a stage with lots of shows of virtuosity. Whereas piano four hands pretty much became an established thing in households where people would come together and have fun playing at the piano, and orchestral pieces were arranged for piano four hands so that people could have fun with it. People could more fully represent the orchestral colors with two players rather than just one.
Well, the next one that you brought us is two pianos. This is Mozart's Sonata in D Major for two pianos, the finale. This is performed by Murray Pariah and Radu Lupu. Vic, when you hear that, can you tell which pianist is doing what?
No, I can't. oftentimes they'll tell you on the recording. But what's special about this work is that Mozart wrote a lot of works for piano duet, and he played them with his sister. But this is one of only two works that he wrote for two pianos, and he played this work in public with one of his gifted students, Josefina von Auerhammer. And so it's sort of a rarity, but it's considered one of the great works in the literature for two pianos.
It's a beautiful piece.
It is. And what's funny is that this is the work that sometimes is associated with those experiments in classical music making you smarter. So not only do we have a genius writing this work, but it may rub off a little bit
we're
on
all
you when
a little
you listen to it.
Yeah, we're all a little bit smarter right now after having heard a little bit of that.
The next
one that you wanted us to hear, Vic, is from the French composer Charles Gounod. This is the Concerto for Pedal Piano in E-flat. It's performed by Roberto Proceda on pedal piano and the Swiss-Italian Orchestra conducted by Howard Shelley. Now, what difference does it make that it's a pedal piano there?
This is like having one player and two pianos. The pedal piano was designed in the 19th century for organists who were having trouble getting to practice in cathedrals and in churches. Hmm. So this was designed with sort of a separate keyboard for the feet, which is pretty much like an organ. You're playing bass notes with pedals. We're not talking about the pedals that control the sustaining of notes and the dynamics of a piano, but you're actually playing a separate keyboard. They have now devised a system just several years ago using two grand pianos. There's an Italian organ builder who came up with this. So when Roberto Proceda plays this, and he's only been playing for about 5 years, the pedal piano, he's actually playing a grand piano, and his feet are controlling pedals that are playing another keyboard of a grand piano.
We actually had a pedal piano in our house. It was one day my dad came home and said he had just bought a pedal piano to go along with the grand pianos that were in the house. But we always, as kids, thought that one was much more fun to play with because you could use your feet.
Sure, sure. And it may well catch on, but I guess Roberto Proceda is sort of the pioneer in our time. He's gave the first performance in our time of the Concerto by Gounod just 5 years ago.
Mm. Well, the last one that we have from you, Vic, is from Beethoven. This is Symphony No. 7 in A major, Opus 92, the finale, for 40 hands. And we're going to explain that in a minute. The conductor here is Johann Berkhammer. So there are 20 pianos playing here?
There are 20 pianos. They're in a circle with the pianists looking inward. So this huge circle of pianos. This was done to celebrate the 20th anniversary of a Dutch piano dealer and piano tuner, and his piano-playing friends came together. Johann Berkhammer arranged the finale of Beethoven's Symphony No. 7 for 20 pianos. And what's exciting is that composers over the years have done more and more with pianos, have added more pianos to try to represent all of the parts, all of the voices of orchestral music. Well, here, let's take it to its extreme. And he has a few pianos representing the strings and a few with the winds and a few with the brass and sort of brings this all together in a grand fashion.
It must be incredibly complicated to arrange a piece for 20 pianos.
One would think so, but this is the challenge that orchestrators and composers have taken on for years. If the possibility is there, why not?
Why not? Vic DiGeronimo, who hosts Classic Mornings on WILL-FM, Illinois Public Media in Urbana, Illinois. Thank you so much. Very interesting.
Jeremy, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
More than 100,000 Central American families and young people have come to the U.S. this year to escape violence at home. The Obama administration has expanded an asylum program for some of these migrants, but it's getting mixed reviews in the Washington, D.C. area, which is home to thousands of Salvadorans. And as Armando Truhl from Here and Now contributor WAMU reports, the change has come too late for one Maryland father.
Mario is in his bedroom in his modest Langley Park, Maryland apartment. We're only using his middle name and those of his family members because he fears for their safety. He's lived here legally for nearly 15 years, working as a carpenter and sending money to his family in El Salvador. The soft-spoken immigrant takes down a photo of a smiling young woman that hangs over his twin bed. His hands shake as he holds the photo. It's his 20-year-old daughter.
Conmigo era buena y se alegraba cuando yo llegaba.
She was always so happy when I would visit her in El Salvador, and so was my granddaughter.
Last year, in El Salvador, Mario's daughter, Maribel, began getting death threats from the Barrio 18 gang. Her boyfriend was a member of the rival MS-13 gang, and Maribel had been marked for death and retaliation. So Mario decided to bring his family to the United States. He applied to the U.S. government's Central American Minors Program, known as CAM. It allows parents who were in the U.S. legally to apply for visas for children and qualifying family members fleeing imminent violence. Mario petitioned his daughter, wife, son, and granddaughter. George Escobar is a manager at CASA, a Latino advocacy group in Langley Park, Maryland. He says Mario's application was one of many his organization pre-screened last year.
There was just hundreds and thousands of families that felt that their children living in El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala were in imminent threat and were trying to do something to bring them in the right way, the legal way.
Mario and his family filled out forms, submitted blood and DNA tests. He was interviewed here by a refugee agency under contract with the U.S. government. His family began the process at the U.S. Embassy in San Salvador. Escobar says it takes patience.
This whole process takes about 8 to 9 months.
Mario and his family waited for months, hoping that they would soon be reunited in the U.S. But then it all went bad. On a recent trip to El Salvador, I visited Mario's family. They were hiding out in a small three-room farmhouse at the end of a dirt road in a remote village. Mario's wife, Antonia, says she can't forget the night Maribel was taken away.
Ella estaba durmiendo con su hija en su cuarto cuando llegaron a tocar las puertas.
She was sleeping with her daughter when they knocked on the door. And I didn't want to open, but they said, "Police, open up."
It wasn't police. It was gang members. That morning, Maribel's body was discovered. She'd been beaten and shot. Now, Antonia lives in fear for the rest of her family.
When dogs bark, I think a car is coming. I think that knock on the door is coming. I'm living in fear.
Stories like these have spurred the White House to do more for some youth fleeing the ongoing violence in Central America. Age restrictions on children applying for CAM will be lifted, and the relative list expanded. The Obama administration said a deal is in the works that allows up to 200 migrants under immediate danger to wait out the U.S. asylum process in Costa Rica. Amy Pope is Assistant National Security Advisor at the White House.
That's a big deal. We have not done something like this in the region before.
But immigrant advocates say these steps don't address the magnitude of the problem. They say asylum applications from Central America are in the tens of thousands. This year, 122,000 families and children have crossed the U.S. border so far. Abel Nunez is executive director of Carecen, a D.C. immigrant advocacy group.
Well, I think it was an attempt by the administration to kind of put a Band-Aid on what really is a huge wound.
But those who want tighter immigration laws have criticized the CAM expansion. Dan Stein is the president of the Federation for American Immigration Reform. He says President Obama is bypassing Congress.
It's not the purpose of asylum. It's not moral. It's not ethical to allow asylum and refugee laws to be used as sidebar immigration programs.
The Obama administration is trying to balance two competing goals: reduce the flow of undocumented families and youth from Central America, while ensuring those people are protected from violence. Some Central American families are no longer prepared to see if this can be done. After my return from El Salvador, I got a call from Mario. He says his family now plans to head for the U.S. border and try to get across illegally, even though this could derail any chances for asylum. Mario says playing by the rules got his daughter killed. He doesn't want to lose any more family members. For Here and Now, I'm Armando Truhl.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.